Welcome to C2Y Podcast, discussions on child and youth care. My name is Wolfgang Vachon. Today's episode is being released on the opening day of the first World Child and Youth Care Conference in St. John's, Newfoundland. I thought this was a perfect opportunity to have a discussion about what child and youth care practice is. CYC practice, as child and youth care is often known, is primarily a North American idea. Does CYC practice have meaning outside of North America? Could it? This podcast has always made an effort to dialogue with people from other regions to see how we can learn from each other. As CYC as a field discusses professionalization and credentialing, where are we going? Where do we want to go? And why? One of the elders of CYC practice is Jack Fallon. Jack has been working in, writing about, and teaching on CYC practice for over 30 years, and he's still actively engaged in the field. Jack will be doing two presentations at the conference, Finding the Message in the Mess, and Connecting Without Correcting, Avoiding Bad CYC Practice. Welcome, Jack Fallon.
Hello, thank you.
Thank you for joining us. What does bad CYC practice look like, Jack?
Unfortunately, I've spent a lot of time in child youth care. When I first started in the late 60s in New York City, I was very fortunate to work for an excellent child and youth care agency that ran group homes. And one of the things they requested and eventually insisted on with all of the people that ran their group homes was that you get a master's degree in human services. And they actually helped pay for going to school. I started an agency that thought the child and youth care practice was a very sophisticated, complex kind of task. Since then, I've had all kinds of experiences of being told when I was a supervisor of 70 child and youth care workers at a big agency that I didn't need a master's degree and they weren't going to pay me for a master's degree because anybody could supervise child and youth care workers. So it's a really an up and down field. My belief is that the worst, simple thing that child and youth care practice has suffered with in the last 40 years is this belief that a behavioral approach to working with kids is effective. And I think that the reason we try to do that is because we work with very unsafe kind of kids who are very hard to predict in terms of what they're going to do next. So the more you can control them, the safer it is for the adults. But I think we've shown for easily 75 years that behavioral approaches don't work with the kind of kids we work with. You can force a kid who's never gone to school, who uses drugs, who beats people up for years, you can take him into a program and with enough external control, within a few days they're going to school every day, they're not beating people up, they're not using drugs or alcohol, and we think we're being very successful.
So why aren't we being successful if they're doing all these things?
Well, because we have them for about 3 or 4 months at a cost of $50,000 a month. They behave very well. 3 days after they're home, they're back not going to school, using drugs, beating people up, doing the same old, same old. So what we do, unfortunately, in our programs is blame the kids' parents, blame the communities they live in, rather than saying we haven't helped them at all. And we spend an enormous amount of effort playing these cat and mouse kind of behavioral control games, trying to force kids to do what we want without ever really creating a way for them to choose to do that. For example, I always say new workers like those approaches because it helps them feel safe. But when we have treatment plans that say this kid's going to go to school 5 days a week, 6 hours a day, that's a very simple plan that anyone could write. I mean, the kid's mother could have easily written that. I'd like to see people write a plan where the plan is the kid's going to choose to go to school 5 days a week, 6 hours a day. That's a much more difficult thing to accomplish. It takes a lot more skill. It takes a whole different approach to what we're trying to do with kids.
You've written that the role of the coach, the behavior modifier, the promoter of normal, is no longer an effective model. And that's what I hear you saying right now.
Yes, I think we spent a lot of time from the 60s on, and in some very effective and useful books at the time, like The Other 23 Hours, saying that the goal for the child care worker is to get these kids to like them enough to be a role model for them so that they'll say, I want to do a certain kind of thing like go to school or eat my vegetables because Harry, who's a really neat guy, is my chocolate worker, and he does it. And I think we've seen that that's really not that useful of an idea. That's not really what we should be looking at when we're looking at creating relationships with kids. It's not being the most popular or role model kind of focused adult in their lives. It doesn't stick.
How do we create that stickiness then?
Well, there's some very good literature in the last 15, 20 years talking about child and youth care being a relational and developmental profession, not a behavioral profession. So what we need to do, and it's Tom Garfad, who's also going to be at the conference, has written some excellent stuff about what we really try to create with kids is to create a space in between their personhood, if you want, and ours, which is called an interpersonal kind of in-between space, where we can both safely go, both that kid and the adult, and really try to negotiate the differences between them in a safe way. So I always laugh, I say to my students, I teach at Grant McKeown in the bachelor's program in child and youth care, like the logic that you have in your mind, the picture of truth, the way you see it, has got nothing to do with what that kid sees. His logic about what's true in his world is pretty much 180 degrees off of what you think is true. And for you to say, do it this way because I know the truth, they only do it that way because you're forcing them to, and as soon as they go away from you, they go back to their own truth.
So the idea of school, for example, the young person will go to school because, if they don't go to school, they get sanctioned, they get punished. And if they do go to school, they get rewarded and praised. And they recognize in order to live within that structure, they need to go to school. So they go to school and they're following those rules. What does the young person want? How do we bring the young person to the point, and is this our role, to have them choose school?
Well, here's one of the problems with school. If you don't have a future perspective, if you don't care what happens next month or next year, school is a pretty silly place to spend your time. It's kind of like if you believe the world was going to blow up tomorrow, you wouldn't pay your Visa bill this afternoon. So the kids we work with live really day to day, and they're in a very much of a survival mode. The kids we work with have all, because they don't come to us unless they've been determined to have been abused and or neglected. And what happens when someone has been abused and neglected for long periods of time, when they were very young, is they live in this hypervigilant survival mode all the time. So they're not particularly worried about what's going to happen next week or next month. I worked with a 15-year-old boy in New York who, on a Thursday, said, "Lend me a dollar. I'm getting my allowance tomorrow, and I'll pay you back." And I thought, well, this would be an interesting kind of a test to see if he follows through. So I lent him a dollar. Friday, he disappeared without paying me. Saturday, the same boy said to me, "Lend me a dollar. Next Friday, when I get my allowance, I'll pay you back." And I laughed, and I said, "You got to be kidding." I said, "I lent you a dollar on Thursday, and you didn't pay me back, and now you're trying to do the same thing again." And I had a very good relationship with this kid. I'd known him for a couple of months, and he just got very upset, kind of yelled in my face, "Why are you always bringing up the past?" And then walked out of the room, slammed the door. And I remember standing there being kind of stunned, thinking, what was that about? And little by little, I started to watch this kid more carefully and realize that he lives in like a three-hour bubble. Like nothing that happened 3 hours ago and nothing that's going to happen 3 hours from now doesn't even enter his mind. So suddenly I found, as I understood that about him, that he was using an enormous amount of skills and resiliencies to survive. Instead of me seeing him as always being kind of in trouble and, lying, stealing, cheating, whatever, I saw him being very, very resilient.
What was his logic then? You talked about the logic being 180 from...
His logic was he never had any control over his life and his whole life. People did things to him all the time. They abused him, neglected him, they moved him around. So he never made any plans about anything because he didn't control it. He literally just lived with whatever was right in front of him and he never had any sense of causing what happened to him. So to work with him around, let me tell you what the right answer is, it was foolish because you needed to help him kind of expand his ability to feel in control of his life before you did any of that other stuff.
And a young person living in, this was residential care you were working with him
in? Yeah, it was in a group home, yeah.
Yeah, so the young person in a group home, there's not a lot of choice. We tell them when to wake up, when to go to sleep, when to eat, what to eat, when to go to school, who they can bring home.
That's part of the bad practice we do. I mean, we don't have to do it that way, you know. Let me give you an example. When I worked in this group home, we wanted to get the kids to get themselves out of bed in the morning because we realized that we were getting them up every morning to go to school on time. And as soon as they went home, they slept in and then said, my mom doesn't wake me up, you know, that kind of stuff. And we realized these are like 14 to 18-year-olds, and they really need to get themselves out of bed. So it took us a long time. I mean, this is not simple stuff. But first thing you did was buy everybody an alarm clock, which was pretty silly because within a couple of days, all the alarm clocks were broken and lost or gone, you know. So then what we did, we realized as we were working with kids who were getting to be a bit more aware of themselves, I would sit down with them on a Wednesday, and it was always a Wednesday, and say, I'm going to give you an alarm clock so that tomorrow I want you to get yourself up by yourself and go to school. I'm not going to wake you up. And they would say, well, what if I don't? And I'd say, well, if you don't, I'll write a note. You won't get in trouble. Oh, okay, so they said, now you're going to give me an alarm clock. If I don't get up, I sleep, then, you know, I said, yeah. They'd say, okay. And then at dinner that night, they would announce to the other kids, I don't have to go to school tomorrow. Jack's going to give me a note because I'm going to sleep in. And all the rest of them would say, how come I can't do that? And so I would explain, I'm giving him an alarm clock. And so everybody else would say, well, give me one, too. He said, well, you're not ready yet. He's ready. And then that night, before this kid would go to bed, I'd say, tomorrow I want you to get up because I think you can. And I think, you know, you need to learn how to do that. And I said, if you do get up regularly for about 2 weeks, you can set your own bedtime, okay? And what would happen is, then the reason I did it on a Wednesday, because I wanted them to only have to do it 2 days in a row before the weekend, because if I did it on a Sunday night, it would be too hard to do it 5 days in a row. And what would happen with these kids, about half the time, they would be able to do, they would just need that kind of incentive, and they'd be able to get themselves up and learn how to do that. Now, we're talking about 15, 16, 17-year-olds who really should be able to do that, but these kids are very immature because of their, again, abuse, neglect experiences. They're not thinking with any kind of perspective of, I need to learn these skills, you know. So things like that can work very well.
And it did work.
It did work, absolutely. You don't need a rule saying, I'm going to punish you if you don't get up.
I remember a young woman I was working with who spent a great deal of her life in care, and she finally got her own place, and she moved in with her brother, and the entire first semester was gone. And she, you know, I asked her what was going on, and she said, I never had to get out of bed myself. I've never learned how to get out of bed. I've never learned how to get up and get going in the morning. It's always been done for me. Breakfast was always there for me. And that was one of the first times I realized how what you would call bad practice.
Yes. One of our bad practice ideas is that we try to get kids to be compliant. In other words, we want them to do what we tell them to do. And we spend months and all kinds of energy doing that. Well, when they leave, all they've learned is how to be compliant, so now they're compliant with the gang leaders, with the drug dealers, and all the rest. Like, we've made them worse instead of better by having them have no ability to, say, make their own decisions, you know.
Karas and Stewart, who you, Karas Garabagi and Carol Stewart, who you refer to, they recently wrote a book called Right Here, Right Now, and I interviewed Carol Stewart on this show, one of my first interviews, and they talk a lot about this idea of agency and fostering agency in young people.
Absolutely.
And I also recognize that can be really, really challenging for child and youth care practitioners, because what you're saying is, let's give a space for the young person to be autonomous and challenge us and show their independence and fail. And as you say, you know, safety is a concern. And so we see people fail and get hurt and have problems. How do we support agency as child and youth care practitioners in a way that's going to be helpful for them?
Well, two things. When you use the word fail, I see that as an excellent learning opportunity. Like, our job is to have learning occur, not to have good behavior occur. So literally, I learn more sometimes when I screw up than when I do it the right way. particularly if I had to make those decisions, somebody else didn't tell me how to do it, right? So I don't think of it as kids making failing. I see them making constructive, useful mistakes that then you sit down, instead of sitting down after a kid decides not to go to school and get high at 9 o'clock in the morning, you say, okay, now what did that create? What did you learn from that? Like, where are you going to go next? Like, how does that fit with what you're trying to do? You know, that kind of thing. You don't have to then say you have to stay in tonight because you've been bad. That doesn't teach them anything, you know.
And what does that conversation teach them?
Well, it gets them. First of all, you have to have a relationship with them. You can't just do this with a brand new kid you've never met before. And often, if you're a new staff member, you don't have the skills to do it. But a skilled child and youth care worker with a kid that they've started to create a relationship with, they can start to have those conversations. Now, you also might say, because you did that, you've got to do some kind of other work. So there's not just, but it's the point of you're not punishing them with some artificial, quote, logical consequence, which isn't logical to any of the kids. You know, what you're actually trying to say, how can we use this to create a learning kind of opportunity for you? And that changes the whole focus of what you're doing, and it takes that punitive, I'm going to make you do it my way, out of it, you know?
That idea of learning sounds an awful lot like the theory behind social pedagogy or social education. What would you say the relationship is to CYC work, to things like social pedagogy or to other practices around the world?
Okay, I've done a lot of traveling around to look at child and youth care in different places, and Sweden, Denmark, Germany, the Netherlands, they describe social pedagogues. And for example, if you were going to work in any of those four countries, Norway too, you'd have to go to school for at least 4 years. You'd have people getting that master's degree, that graduate level credential. And what they learn to do is how to use physical activity and daily life events in a very complex, you know, strategically constructed way to get kids to see some of the learning that they need to have in a very, very real and physical way, so that they can start to, again, create that agency in kids. But it doesn't look like what we do in North America with some of this behavioral stuff. My biggest problem with the programs in North America is that most of them are run at the top level by people who don't understand life space work. They just want everything to run smoothly. And so that becomes the message that trickles down right to the front line, is that we just want these kids to behave. And that's what we're trying to do. And you don't have that perspective in Europe.
So where did this, I know you talked about, you know, coming out of the 60s and this behavioralist approach, which was all the rage then. I think there's a lot of evidence that the limits of a behavioralist approach, and that absolutely it appears to show results very, very quickly. And our jails are full of people who've experienced a behavioralist approach in group homes and et cetera, et cetera. How do we shift our practice here in North America to reflect these other practices from around the world?
Well, I think two things. A lot of the writing in child and youth care, and some of the people like Carol Stewart and Kiros and, you know, lots of other people have been saying for 15, 20 years that we have to move into a developmental and relational perspective. That in fact, the kids we work with developmentally are very different than your normal average kid because of their abuse and neglect. I always laugh. I say, if you know 2-year-olds, they say no to everything. They push and shove each other when they want some of the different toy. They only think about themselves, you know. And so I say to people, do you think 2-year-olds are sociopaths? And people laugh and say no. And you say, well, why not? They act like a sociopath. And they say, well, because they're only 2 and they're going to grow out of it. You say, well, the kids that we work with have had things happen to them, this abuse and neglect experience from a very young age for long, extended periods of time, have developmentally kept them thinking like a 2-year-old. So when I hear people talk about reactive attachment disorder, for example, and the psychiatric diagnoses, I think, you know, if you grew up in a normal family and couldn't attach to people and lived in this hyper-vigilant day-to-day state, maybe you would have a psychiatric problem. the kids we work with have very legitimate, logical reasons for acting the way they do. They're not crazy. We're crazy for thinking they're crazy.
So if we've had this writing for 15 years, and I agree there's been a tremendous amount of writing, why are we not seeing it in practice?
I think there's two reasons. The people who are running programs started in their careers 15, 20 years ago and haven't read this stuff. I think you and I chatted just quickly that the literature, there's an excellent journal in the Child and Youth Care Journal, the Relational Child and Youth Care Practice in Canada, that gets read by less than 1,000 people an issue, when there's 100,000 people should be reading it. I think your podcast is another good example of we needed to get out and tell people this child and youth care work. People think that anyone can do it because in the first year of practice, particularly in family support work, residential care, school work, community work, where you're dealing in the life space a lot, it takes about a year for people to start to feel safe enough themselves that they can begin to use theoretical perspectives to help the kids we're working with. So that in the first year of practice in child and youth care, and I think it's true in a lot of professions, in teaching and social work too, you could take someone with no training at all and they'll act just as well or as badly as someone with a lot of training because they're still managing their own anxiety. When you do that, you say, well, you don't need any training to be a child and youth care. I can take someone with a high school diploma because I can teach them behavioral approaches, which require maybe a 15-hour workshop is all you need to be able to do that well. And you say, well, that's all they need. And my problem is that a lot of people don't even know what good child and youth care practice looks like because they've never seen it. I always say, you think you're a good dancer, so you see somebody dance better than you, and you say, oh, my God, that's what it looks like. I didn't know that.
as someone who comes from a theater background, I can relate to that example very well. You were very early involved, very early in your in the process of certification, you were involved.
Yes.
And in December of last year, December 2012, I had a podcast episode where I interviewed Dana Fusco. And then in that episode, we discussed professionalization and credentialing. This spring, the spring issue of Child and Youth Care Services, which is another journal in our field, had a special issue called Professionalization Deconstructed, Implications for the Field of Youth Work. And it's broader than just CYC work. In that issue, I also have an article called Do Not Enter. What are the risks of gatekeeping child and youth care? A couple questions I want to ask you. Let me start with, why do you think it was really important to create a certification process for child and youth care?
I think certification is a critical process for our profession, and it started actually in Alberta in 1982. It's interesting. People don't realize that you can't even apply for certification until you've been working for at least a year. So you could have a master's degree from the University of Victoria in child and youth care and or a bachelor's degree, and you'd need to work a year before you could apply. And the reason is you can't really do good theoretical complex child and youth care until you've managed your own anxiety, and it takes about a year to do that. But there aren't any professions that I know that don't have some kind of a certification program. I mean, you get out with a PhD in psychology and you still have to do 900 hours of supervised work before you're allowed to practice on your own. The teaching has that whole year of, internship. And, I think it's a very straightforward. I mean, I can't imagine anybody saying certification is not a good idea. Because what it is saying, it's saying not only do you know the theory, but you're actually physically able to implement it in a life space. Like you're looked at by other mature practitioners who are your peers, and they say, yes, you can do this job. And I think that's absolutely critical to our work.
And what makes CYC work a unique profession and different than other professions, social work or youth work or teaching or any other profession?
Well, two things. I think child and youth care work, you're working with a very interesting and I think typically a specific client base. Even though I know people work in schools with normal kids, you really end up working with the kids that are most troubled. You're working with people who are on the low end of the social skills kind of spectrum, if you want, because they're very egocentric and they're not particularly worried about be nice to the people and they'll be nice to you. They don't even think about that. So we work with people who have some real emotional, social kind of different ways of seeing the world. We also work in the life space. I always laugh. Most of the ethical rules that people see in human services are based on an office-based practice. They describe how you should have relationships in what they will be called a neutral space. When child and youth care work is done in a natural space, you're not in an office. You're not pretending that you know anything you say here is never going to leave here, you know, that kind of thing. You're working with people in their lives, and because of that, you're co-experiencing what's happening. So I am as affected by what's going on as you are. We're affected differently, but we're living this together. And when it works well, our, if you want, interpersonal and between space, where we try to share our own different logic about what's true, as we experience things together, we have more and more opportunities to come to a, if you want, a mutual truth. The logic that the kids I work with come from is you never would ever say anything that would get you into trouble. That would be bad. It's morally bad to admit that you did something when they can't prove it, right? Now, Kohlberg, moral development, describes that very accurately, and that's your basic 2-3-year-old. So when I have a kid comes home from school, and I say, how was school today? And he says, it was great, I went to all my classes. And he knows the school's going to call in an hour, and I know, and the school calls an hour later and says he wasn't in school today, he was off somewhere else. And I confront this kid, and I start calling him a liar and maybe even a pathological liar because he knew, you know, and I get disappointed because I thought I had a good relationship with him. You know, I go through all that stuff. I probably sit down with the other workers and we all agree there's something really wrong with this kid. When really what's happening is it would be morally wrong for him to admit that he wasn't in school. I shouldn't be asking him when he comes home if he went to school or not, because I'm setting him up to actually either lie to me, you know, in terms of doing something that's morally wrong for him, you know, by him saying I didn't go to school, he's doing the right thing. So when I yell at him an hour later, what he understands is I don't understand a thing about him. Like, how can he believe that I'm able to help him when I'm literally asking him to do something that's morally wrong?
So what do we ask him when he comes home?
You don't ask him about school because that's a setup question.
So what do we ask him?
You say, how was your day? And whatever. But you don't ask him to, like, I know I'm going to find out whether he went to school or not in an hour. So why am I setting him up to actually tell me something I know isn't true? As I get to understand his moral logic, I won't ask him questions that force him to either, you know, betray his own beliefs about what's right and wrong, or lie to me. That's just a foolish thing to do. But that's very complex. Now, can you imagine trying to describe that to someone who's got a 15-hour course in behavioral reinforcement, you know? They wouldn't know what you were talking about.
That's true, and they wouldn't do it either.
No.
On this morning of the first World CYC conference, where are we going? What do the next 15, 20 years look like for this field?
I think we're going into a better awareness of what treatment really looks like, that treatment is not forcing people to do the right thing, that the task is much more complex than just getting kids to march in a straight line, that children who are neglected and abused at a young age literally have brains that are physically different, and I think there's been a lot of, Bruce Perry's done some excellent stuff and other people, our whole awareness of how attachment and low attachment ability really affects you developmentally. All this stuff is coming out more and more clearly. That these kids don't have psychiatric conditions. They have very logical responses to the physical environment they've been put in. There's all kinds of things that are becoming clearer to us. You know, this whole idea that we should be following the ethical rules of an office-based, psychiatric, psychological profession, when really we're working in the life space with people in much more physical ways. I think all of that's going to change. One of the things that I think is clear to me and what I try to get my students to hear is we don't do verbal counseling because it's not that effective. These kids' brains reject all of those messages. We actually have to communicate with their hearts, not with their brains. So that we literally have to work with kids where they feel comfortable enough with us that they'll sit next to you and watch a TV program, even though their brain is saying, don't get too close to that crazy adult, you know. And but their heart will say it, but it feels nice to sit next to them.
I quite like that. We communicate with their heart, not their brains.
Absolutely. We have to physically communicate. I wrote years ago that really what child and youth care work is you're an experience arranger. You're creating experiential moments that contradict what their brain is saying.
As we wrap up this conversation, is there anything else that you think is important for us to reflect on about good and bad CYC practice?
Yeah. I want to just have you think of two things. The worst terminology that child care workers use is a term called logical consequences, because it's not logical to the kids, and it's not a consequence, it's a punishment. So I'd like to see people stop using that term completely. The other thing we need to do is to realize that one of the mantras of child and youth care work is consistency. And what we mean by consistency is we have to treat all the kids the same for the same behaviors, because we don't want them to get confused. And we have to all, as adults, act the same so the kids see us all as one voice, so they don't split us and all this psychiatric stuff. And I think that's a very foolish idea. That consistency is not useful between kids and between adults. I need to be consistent inside myself and consistent with an individual kid. But I need to treat each youth I work with very differently, because they're very different people. And the workers I work with, we have all have different skill levels, so I shouldn't be consistent with all the other workers, because we'll all end up working like the least skilled worker. So I think that many times new workers are told consistency is the most important thing, and I think that that's a foolish concept. The other is that logical consequences thing.
Those are two well-established, well-cherished terms, I appreciate very much you bringing awareness to them. What term should we use instead of logical consequence for the course I teach next semester on this?
Well, two things. You should say, first of all, that what's logical to me isn't logical to those kids. I always say, I wish that my wife shared my logic, because then she'd do it my way. You know, like nobody has the same logic as you. And then we're suddenly trying to say, if you're nice to other people, they'll be nice to you, you know, and all that stuff. They just look at us like we're crazy. You know, and so then we say, well, because you did this, you're going to get that. They don't believe that. They just think you're in a bad mood and you're taking it out on them, you know. So I don't think that when we talk about consequences with people that don't have a causality, logic, you're wasting your time. Fritz Rettel said this 50, 70 years ago, you know. So I just think it's a foolish idea. It's a behavioral idea that works fine with people who are relatively normal. But the kids we work with are normal inside of their own experience. But their experience has been very different than mine. I always say that the people we hire to do child and youth care work are people who really like other people and all the rest, and they're probably the worst people to hire because they're so different than the kids we work with.
Well, that opens up a whole other conversation about who we should be hiring.
Oh yeah, we have to constantly remind ourselves. One of the things that I keep saying is, you need to be aware when you say something like logical. You've got to have this other voice, you know, your kind of reflective practitioner voice saying, that's a silly thing to say because it's only logical to you, even as you're saying it, you know.
Mm-hmm, certainly. Jack, thank you very, very much for the work you've done over your career and the work that you continue to do. And thank you particularly for joining us today.
I really enjoyed it, and thank you for having these podcasts, Wolfgang.
Oh, you're welcome. Goodbye.
Goodbye now.